Mention the name Rudyard Kipling and what comes to mind? Maybe his children's book, Just So Stories? Or The Jungle Book, which became a Disney classic?
Look for the bare necessities, the simple bare necessities. Forget about your worries and your strife. I mean the bare necessities are Mother Nature's recipes that bring the bare necessities of life.
Oh, kind of a catchy tune, don't you think? Kipling was a man of strong political views who always loved the British Empire. He grew up in British India, and he wrote about its racial politics in his most famous novel, Kim.
Kim was English. Though he was burned black as any native, though he spoke the vernacular by preference and his mother tongue in a clipped, uncertain sing-song, though he consorted on terms of perfect equality with the small boys of the bazaar, Kim was white, a poor white of the very poorest.
The novel Kim is still a pleasure to read, 100 years after it was written. But what should we make of Rudyard Kipling himself? He was a diehard British imperialist, author of the notorious poem The White Man's Burden. Has he become an embarrassment? It's the question David Gilmour tackles in his biography The Long Recessional. Kipling once shaped a generation of world leaders. In fact, you'd be hard-pressed to name a writer who had more influence on the 20th century. As Gilmour told Anne Strainchamps, Kipling is a case study in how literary reputations rise and fall.
His great decades are the last two decades of the 19th century. Firstly, in the 1880s, when he was in India and writing his stories and poems. And in fact, no serious British writer had been in India doing this. So he was actually informing not only the British in Britain, but all the way around the world. And then when he came back in 1889 to England and lived for a while in London, he became the sort of spokesman of the British Empire. He suddenly decided, having been brought up in this Indian ambiance, he came back to London and suddenly was aware of the threats to the British Empire.
What was it he so admired about the British Empire? Had he just sort of fallen in love with British India?
He was born in Bombay, so his infancy was there. And then he came back at the age of 16 and became a journalist. He was a child of the empire. At that particular time, it wasn't something that he needed to question. It was a fact of life that the British were in India. He didn't start thinking, oh, what is the empire up to or whatever. It was the life he accepted. It was only later, when he came back to Britain, that he felt that the empire was much misunderstood.
Will you tell me about some of his stories? Most people these days, I think, don't read Kipling, or if they think of him, they think of maybe Jungle Book and the Just So stories. But, I mean, what of his writings should we know?
Well, Kipling was almost the most versatile British writer of all time. It's difficult to place his writing because so much of it is so diffuse. But what has survived is this imperial rhetoric, much more than the sophisticated short stories of the 1920s, which is, I think, a pity. Of course, the other thing that survived a lot is the Jungle Books, but I fear that's more because of Disney. And
yes.
The best thing about him, the best work that he's still remembered for, and he's actually read a great deal, is that wonderful novel of Inter Kim.
Oh, is that the one that I think E.M. Forster, you know, who wrote Passage to India, said there were some passages in it that were the best things ever written about India?
He thought that Kipling's description of Indians on the Great Trunk Road that stretches across northern India was the most wonderful thing that any Englishman had written about. And it still is, I think. If you look at it again, you almost feel you're there.
What is Kim about?
Well, Kim is not, of course, at all an imperialistic novel. It's about this young, half-Irish, half-Indian boy who is brought up more or less among the slums of Lahore and becomes the disciple, the chela, of this lama from Tibet. And it is their quest, or is the lama's quest for enlightenment, that is the main background of the whole story.
Hmm.
And the joy in it is actually the sheer knowledge and understanding of somebody who knew India. And again, this is sometimes quite difficult to reconcile with the more blatant imperialist exhortations that Kipling gives in The White Man's Burden, for example.
Yeah, that's interesting because I think so many British colonials thought of the Indian natives as, you know, sort of subhuman, and they thought of the white man as just innately superior. But did Kipling think that as well?
No, Kipling, whatever else he felt about India, and he was often critical about some Hindu religious customs like child marriage and the refusal to allow Indian women out of the purdah to be visited by doctors and so on. He was very critical about that. But if you read Kim, you could see that this is actually written by somebody who, whatever else he felt, really loved India. He much preferred Indian India to British India. And even when he was in the British areas, he spent some time at his... he was a Freemason, and what he really loved was the fact that all his brothers there, they could be Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs, and himself. He believed that at that time the British did certain things like administration or building bridges better than the Indians did. But I don't believe that he had any sort of philosophical racism or that type of racism that people believe that they have better brains or pure blood than others. That wasn't Kipling.
You mentioned, as a contrast to a novel like Kim, some of his other more rhetorical poems like White Man's Burden and some of the others. Tell me about some of those. What sort of language was in them?
Well, this was Kipling more or less writing his anthems based on the Old Testament language. They're very powerful at the time. And the poem that he wrote for Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee in 1897, it's called Recessional, which is not a triumphant poem celebrating the greatness of the empire, but it's a warning that all empires are transient, all of them are vulnerable, and that people need to be humble and understand their responsibilities rather than go on trumpeting about them. The other great poem, notorious poem, I want to say, of that particular period is, of course, The White Man's Burden. And the last verse of The White Man's Burden, and is done in a very sort of patronizing way to start with. He writes, "Take up the white man's burden, have done with childish days, the lightly proffered laurel, the easy ungrudged praise. Comes now to search your manhood through all the thankless years, cold, edged with dear-bought wisdom, the judgment of your peers." And what he's really saying there is that the United States has come of age. It's a young country, but now it is, and we're talking about 1898, it's now ready to share overseas burdens with Britain. As I say, it's a pretty patronizing way of putting it.
Kipling won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1907. He was only 41, and he was, you know, the most admired writer of his day. Henry James, I think, called him the most complete man of genius he'd ever known. By 1942, things were completely different. George Orwell said that every enlightened person despised Rudyard Kipling. What happened?
The great dividing line is the Boer War, the war in South Africa, which was in many ways a fiasco and in many ways was unnecessary. And after that very expensive war, there was a big mood change among the British public. They didn't want the Conservatives back in power. They voted for the Liberals, and the Liberals remained in power for a long time and were far less interested in the empire. And so Kipling became a prophet in the wilderness.
You used the word prophetic about him, and in fact, he does seem to have been remarkably prophetic about world politics. Didn't he predict the coming of apartheid, among other things?
He felt sure that if, after the South African War, if Britain was going to give self-government to the Boer population there, that they would end up maltreating the blacks. But he foresaw a lot of things. He foresaw the World Wars, the first one about two decades before it happened. He even managed to predict more or less the date and what it would be called. And he predicted what would happen when the British left India, that the sectarian problems and violence between Hindus and Muslims. I think he was prophetic too often for it to be regarded as a fluke.
So he was both the great champion of the empire, but also foresaw its decline.
Exactly, and he knew its decline would take place much quicker than almost anybody else did. In fact, he accosted my wife's grandfather in about 1930 at a club in London and said, "I hate your generation." And the poor man said, "Well, why?" And he said, "Because they're going to give it all away." And I think he would have been just about the only person in Britain who would have actually realised quite how quickly the whole thing would disappear, and that now we have Britain just by itself, which is exactly 1% of the size of the British Empire. This has been quite a difficult thing to live with. As Dean Acheson famously said once, the British have lost an empire, but they haven't found a role. And that has dogged the last 50 years of British life.
David Gilmour talking with Anne Strangechamps. Gilmour's biography of Rudyard Kipling is called The Long Recessional.